everyone. This is Whole Life, and it's a whole crew. It's a Tuesday afternoon. Everything's out of whack. VBS has our brains warped. And we're on a tight deadline.
Out there right from the beginning.
You know, I'm just prefacing.
Let's be clear, we're having a good time.
We are.
We are having a great time. It's and a great VBS.
And the kiddos are having an even better time than us.
They are.
Yes, they are.
And that's how you know it's a success.
Yeah, it's been awesome.
Yeah. No, the smiles. I'm on stairwell duty, and you see the them going up and down and then fighting for position, and it's like, wow. It's been a long time since we've been that size and cared about being first in line as we go up the stairs. And
yeah.
Well, you know, it's good if they don't want to go when it's go time.
That's true.
Yeah.
No, everyone's ready to go to the next one because there's been.
You had such a good crew of people too. So I wanted to say a huge thank you to all the volunteers who are making this happen. And another huge thank you to all the people that showed up on Sunday. Rochelle told me that she's heard that other churches were decorating until midnight. And we were done by 7.
So, and folks, there's an entire life-size cabin on the stage. Yes. So it's not like, you know,
but
we didn't do anything.
Thanks to Spring Meadows for that. We need to go ahead and acknowledge, you know, where we get assists from. And Spring Meadows actually, I think some of their church members made this. It is an incredible.
Whoever did it.
It's incredible.
Knew what they were doing.
And they're nice enough to let us use it. So
There's
big
waterfalls.
Thanks to
there's kayaks. There's all of them. Bears.
Yeah.
Multiple bears.
Multiple bears, not just one.
Camping tents, lights, it's trees.
I think I'll probably put this in my 60-ish.
Yeah.
I think I'll probably do a little bit of that. And then the other thing.
Do it from inside the cabin.
Since I'm shamelessly promoting things, we have to get all of it taken down Friday afternoon.
Oh.
Because another church is coming to borrow.
Pick it up.
Stuff that some of our stuff, some from all the other churches. So, so we have to get that all taken down. So if you have time Friday afternoon, you work at one of those jobs that lets you be done by noon, come over here to the church, 1 o'clock. We might even have some food for you and just help us get this thing taken apart. Aubrey and I both have a goal. She said that it'll go till 5, but I have a goal of being done by 4. I know. And that's going to be hard because that's 3 hours. It took us 7.5 hours to get it all put together. But I just feel like all things are possible.
Taking down is better than putting up.
It is. Sure. But we do need, but I'm a little bit worried we won't have as many people. So seriously, if you have some time Friday afternoon and you happen to be near 2800 North Orange Avenue. Drop by, even if it's for 45 minutes. We'll take whatever help you can give.
And take a look at our social if you're not. The swipe up in the show notes links to all. But if you look at Instagram, I know for sure there's a little sizzle on there that shows all the smiling faces that worked for 7 hours on Sunday. So if we only work for 5 or 4, think about how much bigger the smiles would be on Friday if you came.
Or even 2, you know, 2 or
3.
Or
even a half an hour, you just stop by.
Lucas likes staying here as late as he can, but we want to take that joy away from Lucas. We want to rob him of that joy.
We want to rip the other half oar out of his hand and just and make sure he does.
I wanted to see him with a half oar, one of those kayaks up on the stage. I feel like they should fear that into one of the skits.
I think he should be at the top of the falls with that half oar ready to
just
plummet.
Ready to go.
Thank you. That sounds amazing.
Maybe for tomorrow. All right. So what did you do with your dad that was your favorite thing together? Melanie, go.
With my dad?
Yeah.
What? Favorite Are you
thing.
Talking about on Father's Day?
Anytime.
Oh, anytime.
Anytime.
Oh. I think the most fun we have is when we're remodeling things together, building something or demolishing something.
So all time?
Yeah, pretty much all the time.
That's what we do when we get together.
That's pretty much what we do.
Demolish things.
I meant an all-time memory.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh.
That's okay if that tops the list.
Well, yeah, I mean,
yeah.
We've worked together in multiple different houses, so it's kind of special.
Demolition.
And building.
Yeah.
Okay. We do that too.
All right. And Ken, I mean, did your dad, in the picture, you and your dad looked pretty snazzy there with that superhero.
You had
like the shirts and
your
dad's mustache was on point.
On point.
That was, I'm like, that was just legit. And then it was the fire truck.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
The Tonka.
Was that for that year?
Yeah, it had the ladder that went all the way up.
The little silver handle that
my brother broke. Yeah, no bitterness. Oh, no bitterness. Man.
No bitterness.
I still actually have that Tonka truck at my house.
Wow.
I think my mom got rid of ours. We used to have the fire truck and dump truck and all that good stuff. So what was your favorite, though? Favorite thing you and your dad did? Like anything?
There's a lot. So I'll pick, because I can't do one. Playing chess with my dad. That's a favorite memory. He started me very young.
Nice.
He never taught me the rules of it, just made me play and beat the snot out of me.
And figure it out.
I don't think I beat him until I was like 17 or 18 because I was so psychologically conditioned to lose. I think I would get,
He's going to win anyway.
He'd only have a pawn and a king left and I'd have all of mine. He'd still beat me because I was so psychologically programmed to lose. But anyway, no.
It's interesting, that's your favorite memory. Yeah. That's where you are.
You know, it taught me some important lessons of life. I love that. My dad would do models. We'd do model like planes and cars and stuff like that. And then probably like one of my favorite memories is just all the times my dad had a motorcycle and you would drive me to school every day and just we'd do motorcycle stuff together.
Mm. That's mine too. Definitely was the motorcycle. So.
Which is where kind of weird because I don't ride a motorcycle.
Yeah.
So my dad tried that, but he was in an accident that I think left a pretty scare the life out of me because it was so bad. It literally, his bike was crushed between two cars to the point where they had to get a tow truck to pry the cars apart to get to the motorcycle. So
yeah.
And I got to drive by that before I knew what had happened to him. So,
ooh,
yeah.
Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
Well, last year was, I don't know, I think the 10th year in a row that my dad and my brother have come down with their Harleys to ride for a week and when the weather in Wisconsin is no good and it's a lot better here. So that's still definitely on my, top on my list. Lucas?
Wow. For me, my dad was an amazing volleyball player. So
really?
Yeah, he almost went pro in Brazil.
Nice.
So he teaches very young and once he got old, he wasn't able to play anymore. So we play something called beauty ball, which is volleyball in the water. He used to say it was volleyball for old people. So we had like 10 people that every week go there and play, and my dad loved those. So it's one of my favorite memories, just playing beauty ball on a weekly basis.
Do you play volleyball still?
Yeah.
How hard can you spike?
Oh, man, I don't know.
You think you can knock me over?
Maybe.
Ooh.
I don't want to find out. I'm just curious. I'll take your word for it.
When the eyebrow went up like this, I'm like, I think he's got a look.
I wish you'd been. I think we may eventually be getting some video in here, but I wish somebody could have seen it because he got a real pure look of joy that thought. I think I would like to try
my half-horse bike.
Yeah, we have a few surprises up our sleeve for the second week of January upcoming for episode 500. So stay tuned for those. Phase one was at least initiated this past week, so we'll probably not let you in.
We are going places.
We are going places. I like that. So today on the podcast, we are talking about wild water stories that just aren't believable. Well, maybe they are.
All right.
Because we are going to talk about the flood, and then we're going to talk about Jonah. Like anybody believes somebody was swallowed by a fish and then gets barfed up 3 days later, right? Come on. And then the whole world was covered by water seems awfully implausible
in
a lot of ways. So,
Randy.
You know, stick with us. We'll get through to those. But before we get there, one of my favorite things Ken talked about was being a younger Ken and questioning things. And I love it when people question things.
Yeah.
And I love it when the hypocrites are there.
Oh, yeah.
Because
they're
never far, but then the closest one is always the one
usually
in the mirror.
In the mirror.
And so I just felt like anyone who has ever walked with Jesus for any amount of time was just like thinking back to maybe a spot in their life where things weren't as smooth as they might be now, and it wouldn't have to be necessarily too long ago. Depends how long your journey is, but like, oh yeah, I remember that phase. But also I want you to know that if you're in that phase, it's okay because, you know, you're in a spot where you're not really trying to impress anybody. You're not trying to like, ooh, I'm a, I'm a scholar, or I know a lot, or I understand everything. I'm just trying to be a good person. And that's enough to start. That's you have to make little steps. And for some of us, those steps are really, really tiny, to speaking for myself. And so it's okay if that's the starting point. And so I love that you got into it with your dad on this trip. And we've all been in the uncomfortable car ride. And then when you get to the destination, it's like, so does this mean a truce? Are we taking this with us on in? And then you're at grandma's house and it's like, no, can't do that to grandma. Cause like, and I love like grandma didn't know. Right. And then you just kind of left everybody hanging like, yeah, we'll revisit that later. And it kept getting later and later and later in the message. I'm like, the band has come up. We got Pad playing underneath. I'm like,
we haven't heard the end yet.
This will be another one of Ken's. I'm going to tell you the story and then I don't.
So I really was like, is he going to just totally diss us and make him like this a podcast only thing? Like, you're going to have to listen to the podcast.
Randy was hoping that's what it was.
I kind of did actually for a moment.
Did.
Before we get there. So did you win?
No, I, my dad crushed me with love.
Dad, good job.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kenny, he said, it always makes me go, when you say Kenny, when you refer to your parents usually calling. So did they call you Kenny for a long time or?
Oh, yeah. So I'm named after my grandfather. He's called Kenny.
Oh.
And so, yeah, I was little Kenny for many, many years and basically all the way through eighth grade. So if you run into anybody who went to elementary school with me,
they would know
they're going to call me Kenny.
Nice.
And that's fine.
I thought Kenny was
totally
a cool
fine
name.
With that. Yeah.
I knew some cool Kennys.
Rochelle refused to call me Kenny because, well, we met in college.
Yeah.
But by that time, it was pretty much everybody was calling me Ken. And but she has a family friend whose name is Kenny, so it
didn't
would
really
feel confusing.
Out.
So, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not really like, it's really, my parents even call me Ken now. But most of the kids I went to grade school with who are not kids anymore, most of them will still call me Kenny when they see me.
And nice.
I think they think it bugs me, which I don't. I just know as soon as I hear Kenny, I know who
it
know,
is.
I know it's somebody that I knew back in.
That's great. It always catches me off guard when you say Kenny, and then I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. He would have been a Kenny, wouldn't he? Probably.
Yeah, little redheaded, freckle face, skinny Kenny.
We said we were going to talk about Noah, and the Bible says Noah is the only blameless person on the entire earth.
Yep.
God wipes it out because apparently it's just him. And then we talk about Job a little bit, but Job is also blameless and upright.
Yep.
He happens after the flood.
Not necessarily.
Right? No. Oh man, I read this in I don't know if that's true, but the chronological Bible, he would have been before the flood chronologically, right?
Probably.
Probably. Like, not for sure. But so how can they both be alive during the same time, but only one of them is blameless and but they're both blameless and upright?
Maybe they weren't alive at the same time.
Okay. Well, maybe Job. Can that be?
If you're trying to figure out the genealogy on this one, it's going to drive you crazy because you're not going to find it.
Dang it. Come on, Melody. I saw you over there like moving a little like, okay, Melody's going to bail me out. And I was hoping that the shovel and the bail and no.
Yeah, sorry. The shovel went the other direction.
Oh, it kept going deeper.
I actually tend to think that it was right after the flood, that it was some period really close to right after the flood.
For Job?
My uneducated feeling on it.
Okay.
So, I mean, there are definitely, I think most theological circles agree that it was probably pre-flood, right, Melanie?
I mean, it depends on who you ask. I don't know.
So I don't know.
If I asked you, what would you say?
I would say pre-flood. That's what I would say. But that would just be my
The reason I feel like post-flood is that the people groups that they name are similar to the post-flood people groups I can't remember what they basically give names of the people that come and steal his sheep and his oxen they're groups that you see in the post-flood era.
Okay. I just thought it was odd that all, but not knowing for sure when those two, or even if we don't know for sure, that I guess with Job, it doesn't say he's the only, it just says he was.
Yep.
Where Noah's like, apparently even his kids and his wife don't make the bill, but they get to come to the, anyone that came in the ark.
It's an interesting thing because it's actually, if you start doing the genealogy, you'll actually realize that Methuselah was still alive during part of Noah's life.
Because he was.
So the question really becomes, when does this assertion get made that he's the only righteous person left on earth? And is it the assertion that Noah's the only righteous person left on earth, or that basically his lineage is the only righteous people left? Because, you know, there's this line of righteous people, apparently, that go through Noah. And one of the things to remember is that Noah actually doesn't have his children, his three boys, until after God has told him that the flood is coming and actually has him start building the ark.
Because Noah was what, 150?
He was 500 when God, the Bible says he was basically 500 when, I think he says he was 500 when God came to him and said that he was going to build the ark.
500, okay.
No, you're right. Chaldeans. I forgot about the Chaldeans. Yep. Post-flood.
Okay.
I'm going with Ken on this one.
Okay. Yes.
Oh. Oh, this is
I feel like dropping
my mic and walking out of here right now.
Gotta leave on a high note.
Thank you. See you next week, guys.
I have nothing more to say.
Episode 471, I believe, is where we are. So we will mark that one down in infamy.
History. Good history for Ken.
So essentially then his family, I mean, I guess anyone that would have come on the ark would have been saved, right?
Yeah.
So even if it wasn't that, his wife and his families, I think, I don't remember where I've read this before, but it was, they likened it to almost like salvation, like almost like Noah was some kind of deity. And I don't think that makes any biblical connections for me, but
I think that there are some people who would say that maybe Noah prefigured Jesus and that he saved people.
Okay. Preaching kind of in the same way. Yeah. I mean, while he was building or.
I'm not saying that for myself. I'm just saying some people say that.
I think that's kind of what I've heard. And I was just trying to draw the conclusion there, but I just don't think there is one. I mean, other than the fact that there's some similarities, maybe. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we have Noah, we have the flood, we have all of the chaos and the destruction. And, you know, I mean, there's still people today that, and it's interesting that this came up, and I don't know, my phone is probably listening to our sermons now, because I've been getting this Christian speaker come up in my reels about why the flood really happened from a scientific and a biblical perspective, like putting the two together. And it's been pretty interesting. So thanks, phone, for helping me out this week while we were going through this. And I'm like waiting for the Jonas to start next. Phone, if you're listening, I'd really like to hear what this guy has to say about, you know, Jonah running from God and, you know, the giant storm. Everyone on board wants to know why, because, hey, God must be the gods, or gods must be unhappy about something or be unhappy with someone. Jonah owns up to it, which is almost the unbelievable part of the story sometimes, because it's like, no.
That's the unbelievable part of the story, Randy.
Well, I'm going to run away. I think I can run away from God when God knows everything. I mean, it wasn't like Jonah wasn't an intelligent person, right? And I can run away from God, and if I'll get on a boat, and I could have just said, nothing. Didn't have to own. I mean, he, you know, was ignoring God. Why not ignore these guys? And then gets himself thrown over, which is sure death in the storm, right? I mean, he has no guarantee that the storm is going to pass once he gets off in the water before this magnificent beast that's never been seen or heard from again comes and swallows him up for 3 days and then pukes him out on the beach 3 days later. So, I mean, I guess that's probably the biggest, most unbelievable part of the story. But
weren't there people who have been swallowed in modern times that
– in a fish?
Or a whale or something.
Or a whale,
like that?
Maybe. I don't know. But to live.
Yeah, a guy was swallowed, I don't know, what is a year or two ago, but the whale immediately, like it wasn't like he swallowed really? Him all the way. He well, was in his mouth.
Maybe I need, well, phone you let me down. You could have given me a few of these to work with in the reels.
It wasn't a 3-day pilgrimage.
No. So. Well, that is, I mean, it would have to be pretty big though. I mean, for you to, I mean, well, of course, maybe there wasn't a lot of space to move or. I don't know.
Well, and we say whale. Yeah. The Bible says fish.
Fish. So. That could mean a lot. But the interesting thing is once you get past all of that, and then I never thought about the fact, like I just thought Jonah was spoiled or just not very mature. But then when Ken's like, look, if you are a true prophet, things you say come true. And if they don't come true, you're not a prophet. So he goes and tells the people he didn't want to tell already. So we know he's upset because
I think that one of the things I didn't emphasize in the sermon, but I would love to emphasize here, is just how much Jonah hated these people. Like, this yeah. is not a people group that Jonah would have been like,
let's go save them.
You know, kind of like, yeah, you know, I could take them, I could leave them. These are people that he would have absolutely hated with every fiber of his being. Because the Assyrians that he's going to go preach to have oppressed Israel. They've been cruel beyond measure to the Israelites, to Judah. And so Jonah would have, these would have been sworn enemies. These have been people that Jonah would have only been too happy to see die in a very, very painful way. Jonah hated these people, just despised them. And so God tells him to go and tell them that God's going to wipe them out. So you'd think, well, Jonah would be excited to go do that. But no, because Jonah has a sense that he might be a good preacher.
But where does that sense come from? Like he thinks that God, I mean, maybe he's a good preacher, but what do you think gave him the sense? Like because he comes back pretty emphatically later, like, I knew you were going to do this.
Yeah.
What would have given him that? Is there something like pre-Jonah where this is maybe happened before that he had to lean on and go, oh yeah, you're going to pull the old whatever on me?
Well, I think that it's so easy to look at the Old Testament and not see God's grace there, but it's there. The Israelites they're constantly not doing what God asked them to do, and He's constantly—that's
true—changing
His mind, constantly like, if you do this, this is going to happen. But you know, I'll wait a little bit longer. But I'll wait. And so I believe that Jonah just really understood who God was. He understood that God. I mean, he just says it. I know that you're slow to get angry and that you don't want to kill people. That's why I didn't want to do this. I knew you were going to change your mind that you wouldn't do this. And to me, it's just one of the more beautiful passages and all. So I love it just because I know I get, like, whenever I try to find as many opportunities as I can to use this text in a sermon because I just love, because I just, in my head, I can just hear, I knew it. You're full of unfeeling love. You're just eager not to kill people. I mean, I just love that. I mean, I can just see myself doing that. I can just see myself losing my mind. Be like, why? These are horrible people. They killed my friends. They killed my family. They tortured. They didn't just kill them. They tortured them. And now you're going to go ahead and do the right thing and wipe these people who truly deserve to be wiped off the face of the earth. You're finally going to do it. But I don't trust you to do it because I just know you're looking for some reason not to do it. And I just love
He's a tortured
that
man.
Picture of God. I love that picture of God, and I love that Jonah knew it. Jonah knew it. Like, Jonah's like, just do it. And God's like, no, no, stop it, God. Just kill them already.
To be so conflicted, I mean, there's no doubt then why he wouldn't have
Jonah wanted wasn't to conflicted. He well, this is yeah. the point. He was completely not. He knew and is like, no, I do not want to
like,
do this.
Why I don't want to go because I know, right? That's just – but the ending of the story always seems anticlimactic because
– God, yeah, God just leaves him pouting on the side of the hill.
And like when you go to read the story – There's nothing after it. It's just like it.
No, the last thing that's mentioned, I think, is the cattle, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I got so. Just that. The last text I read, it's like, well, don't you know there's 120,000 souls, not to mention the cattle and animals in this town, and you're, and the you know the part I don't mention this sermon, but it's, but you know God makes this. Jonah's seen out in the scorching sun, waiting for the town to get scorched, and he's getting sunburned. He's seen out there, and then God causes this plant with this huge leaf to grow over top of him, give him some shade, sends a nice little, and then he sends a worm in the night to kill this plant, and Jonah loses his mind over that. Because if you've ever been hot and tired and angry, I mean, he's like so angry, and God's like, "Why are you angry about that?" He's like, "You know why I'm angry." And guy's like, "Well, if you're upset about this plant that you didn't even make grow, why would I not be equally about?" And see, this is the part that God says, basically, these people bring me joy. They bring me comfort. And watching them die causes me the kind of distress that you're having right now without that plant. You're upset about a plant, but you're not upset about 120,000 people plus all the animals in there. You know, you don't care about them. Don't you know they bring me joy, that they bring me comfort, that and yet you're okay with that. And I can so relate. I don't know, maybe you guys can't, but there are people that have, in my opinion, wronged me or my family, and I have a hard time praying for them. I'm like, I don't want you to do good things for these people. I really want you to help them learn an important lesson.
Yeah.
And I don't want to pray for them because I want you, God, to bring justice. I want you to do. And we look at the people of Nineveh in our current modern context, and we do not understand how much they have made Jonah suffer, and how much that made the people that Jonah cares about suffer. And you're a hypocrite. Going back to, if you think that you are so different than Jonah, and the story of Jonah is a story about, it's about God having compassion on people who absolutely don't deserve it. But those people did, it's one of the reasons why sometimes I don't want to pray for people, because I'm afraid that they will turn to the Lord and then God will have to have mercy on them, which I don't want God to have mercy on these people. They need to suffer because they made me suffer. They made the people I care about suffer. Now they need to suffer. And that's what I love about the story of Jonah, is that God is like, no, look, I have grace for you and I have grace for them. And Ken, just remember who you are. Yeah. Remember who you are. Remember the grace I've had for you and the things that you totally deserve to suffer for that I've given you grace on.
Well, and he gave him a second chance to even get there.
Yeah.
I mean, could exactly. have got, you know, in that instance. But, you know, if you were, if your kids grew up watching VeggieTales, you know that God's a God of second chances. We learned that through Jonah. And also that the,
they were second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, maybe, you know, what does Jesus say? 70 times seven, something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. And the Ninevites were fish slappers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's a whole nother story.
Okay. Now you're going to get me irritated because I had to have a long argument with a ninth grade Bible class about because VeggieTales and their incorrect retelling of these stories. So anyway. Yeah.
They weren't, I don't think they were really fish slappers, but it
I'm glad you know that.
It makes for a good story though. Yeah. You know, anyway. So
some may feel that way.
So the other thing was, do we know how many people approximately were on the earth when the flood happened?
No
clue. Okay. I'm just curious because God takes time to mention it, point it out, put focus on 120,000 that he was saving. And I was wondering, like, is there a correlation to the flood story where, you know, hey, there was 200,000 or there was 100,000 and they were all too bad to be saved, but here's 120 that, you know, we.
Well, and I think that one of the things that's actually worth really thinking about is that the Ninevites, they're told that they're going to be destroyed. They repent. They put on sackcloth. They're like, okay, you're not incorrect. We are.
We're pretty bad.
We're kind of naughty. We ought to. And the king of the country says, hey, we are violent. We need to renounce this. We need to back away from this. And so you do get the sense that they've at least for that period of time, they've said, okay, we need to change our ways. We need to do a course correction here.
I like how you broke down the violence too.
Yeah.
You know, where it wasn't just maybe a physical act of hurting someone, but that it was kind of like society today in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And that just, you know, if God was unhappy with it, then he's obviously still would be unhappy with it today. And that was just a good reminder of what we're up against or what we're a part of. And maybe, like you said, who we may want to pray for, not want to pray for, and who's worthy and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you said, how are you growing in your relationship with God? And he said, I want you to ask hard questions to grow up and mature and know who God is. This is why I love our messages here at Whole Life. And if you guys have been watching the baptism videos, if you catch us online, and you will notice that the last handful of people have just said, man, our messages here are what help really keep me connected. And because it's not always about things that make us feel good or things we can maybe aspire to, but to really, you know, do the hard things and being asked to do the hard things and the, you know, that's all due to our values. I love how the Q&A, you're allowed to ask questions and, you know, we'll try to answer them here in the family environment of online worshipers and in-house worshipers every week, getting a chance to ask those questions. And that invitation just making us all on the same plane, working towards whatever our maturity in our spiritual walk is and that we can grow together. So I really loved the ending of that, giving us a challenge to think about those things.
I really just remind people, like, I wasn't trying to dance away from, I think the flood story is a hard one. It's a hard one to see that God would wipe out all of humanity except for 8 people. That's difficult. That is a difficult one to understand. And so I can understand my friends who look at this story as metaphorical or not true, or that it's just there to make a point about something. I can understand that. I mean, I am from the school that I truly do believe this is something that happened. But if it is something that happened, how bad did it have to be? If God did have mercy on 120,000 people and animals, how bad did things have to be for God not to have mercy on a world that, I mean, how bad? And what are you willing to do? I mean, if you know that your child is going to go murder a bunch of people, what are you willing to do? I'm familiar recently with a parent that knew that their child was going to go shoot up a place, and they reported their child. That's a hard thing to think. But they reported their child to the authorities, and that would be, as a parent, that would be very difficult. And that child is now incarcerated because that parent made a phone call. That would be a hard thing to do. And sometimes parenting is very difficult. But if you know that your child is about to cause massive harm, what do you do?
Right.
And I feel like, you know, as an apologist on this one, I feel like there was no part of God that enjoyed doing what God did. I don't think that God wanted to do it. I think it absolutely left him heartbroken. And I think that God felt like that was the only thing that would keep humanity from being obliterated, and maybe the rest of the planet from being obliterated because of the violence that was going on. Again, difficult questions, and we can all, you know, God's critics certainly can make some points if they want to there. And yet, I think sometimes the just thing is to preserve life where you can. And so, hard story, but I believe we have a good God.
Speaking of questions, did we have any, Lucas?
Yes.
I'm assuming we did, because, like you said, it's a tough one.
Some of the questions we actually just spoke about. One here is, if Noah was the only righteous man at the time, did his sons get some sort of coverage or pass just because they were his sons?
And I love that question. And the answer is, I don't know, but there's a lot of other stories in the Bible where we see families get a pass because of one person. Think about Rahab. Her entire family is spared. Think about Lot. He's able to bring his wife and his children, although his wife turns back. bring out his some of his children. He's actually given the opportunity to bring his son-in-law and some of those people out. Yeah. And so there are a number. And when Paul and Silas are jailed, and their jailer, there's an earthquake, they're freed. The jailer says, "What I must do to be saved?" And it says that he and his household were all saved, or baptized and saved at that point. So there is, it's an interesting question. And there is a fair amount of theological debate on it. There's generally a feeling that we're all responsible for our own personal salvation. Yet the Bible, on a number of different occasions, points out how one person in a family can have a almost a salvific they can actually save their family.
Hmm. Well, I think the reason that we have difficulty thinking about that is because we're so accustomed to Western individualism. Whereas, you know, in other places and throughout history, it wasn't just about you. Even throughout Christianity, it's not just about you and your special personal relationship with Jesus. This is a communal thing. So
that's the genealogies. I mean, and so, yeah, there's it's an interesting thing. And in our Western mind, it's a very hard idea that I'm responsible for me. But that is definitely just one, that's really more cultural than it is a biblical stance.
But it seems unlikely also that, like, if Noah's this person, God calls him to build the ark. They have sons, they're starting to build, and they're helping, and all of this. I mean, even the people that were building the ark were probably up close and personal with Noah on a regular basis. I mean, I don't know how many workmen there were, but it had to be.
You would think a few.
At least, right? But like, it seems odd that his sons would be somehow opposed to what he was doing, to the point where it'd be like, well, look,
I don't know. Just stay with everybody else. Plenty of kids that run in the opposite direction of their family. Yeah, maybe. So I don't know.
Maybe. Good question.
And there is certainly some indication later on that not all of his sons are on the straight and narrow.
Well, that's true. That's a
neither is he. Let's be real here.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Noah falls off the wagon. Hey, Noah falls off the ark.
Literally. Yeah.
that story though. Okay. Moving on.
Yeah, this one is from Anonymous. It seems like preachers go through some real hermeneutical, I don't know how you pronounce it.
Hermeneutical,
yeah. Gymnastics to find a loving God in the flood story. Since versions of this story are found in a variety of cultures and faiths, might we consider it to be an allegory of ancient people trying to understand their world and not mean to be taken literally? Might allowing that not speak more of God's love and patience with the limited understanding of humanity?
Ooh.
Wow.
Yeah, I think I kind of touched on that a little earlier when I said I understand my friends who look at it as an allegory or metaphor, because I definitely understand that. I can totally understand somebody who says you're kind of twisting yourself into a pretzel to make God loving. I don't think I am. And here's why I don't, because I think that loving people, that being loving doesn't mean that there isn't justice and that there isn't consequences. And I think it also doesn't mean that just because you love somebody, I'm a loving person, but the guy up in Minnesota that went and murdered, you know, a husband and wife and it was shot up another family, I don't believe that we just like, well, we love you, good luck to you, continue on.
Yeah.
I think that there's consequences and you have to go ahead and have some consequences in life for things to protect the many from the few or sometimes even the many bad actors. I mean, sure. You look at, I do believe there are things such as just wars. I think that stopping Hitler was a good thing. Do I think that every action the Allies took in that war was just? I don't.
Yeah.
There were some things that we did that were pretty horrendous.
Pretty questionable, for sure, yeah.
But that was a just war from my viewpoint. And so I don't know that I understand my friends who say, I think you're twisting yourself into a hermeneutical pretzel to make God good in this story. And yet I don't, for me, if truly the world was about to wipe itself out, if the human beings were about to destroy the planet in some way, if they're about to destroy each other, is it really a bad God that says, okay, this is about to happen anyway, I'm going to preserve humanity, I'm going to preserve this planet, and this is the only way that I can do it. For me, I don't feel like that's a stretch, but I understand my friends who do think it is.
I think it's worth mentioning, though, that there are other flood stories that predate our flood story, and they're very similar, of a god saying, hey, you need to build yourself something to preserve yourself, and then then sends a flood. And I think plausibility is one of those questions that comes in. Like, is this a time when people have been reading these epics, the Epic of Gilgamesh and some of these other ones, and then letting that inform, the way that they're telling this story about God? The interesting thing is the difference between the Epic of Gilgamesh, for example, and the others, is that typically the gods are represented as being very capricious. One story is that the gods actually just were really annoyed with the noise that the humans were making, so they decided to destroy them.
Wow.
So the way that the Genesis.
But if you've ever had kids. I'm sorry.
The way that Genesis depicts the God of this flood story is that this God actually has the brokenhearted piece about it. But I mean, really, if you look at the plausibility of the fact that there are stories that predate this story, so then you ask yourself the question, well, is it because, yes, this definitely happened because there are all of these stories that sound similar? Or is this story kind of a legend that sort of bled over and then fed into the book of Genesis? And then you look at the genealogical record, or not the genealogical, but the geological record of the way that different sediment settles and all these kinds of things. Did the flood cover the whole earth? Was it a really big flood for one area? If you are in a situation where a hurricane comes through and everything around you is flooded, it can feel like it covers the whole earth, because to you, that is the whole earth. So I don't know. There are definitely questions.
Yeah. Well, I was reading something not that long ago that the shellfish at the near or the top of the peak of Everest. So I feel like if Everest is underwater, everyone else is probably looking up through the waves too.
Using a snorkel?
don't snorkel. If you missed that video, I'm so sorry. Is that it, Lucas? Do we have any more?
We have one list here. I think there is one question that still lingers on my mind. Why does God love us unconditionally in spite of our flaws, our troublesome decisions, and the headaches we give him?
I think that for me, having children is the answer that I've come to on that. I just adore my kids. And I know that whatever they do, I just love them. I just think they're fantastic. And I just think that God loves us in something similar to that. That we are flawed. We aren't perfect, but we mean so much to God. And so, that would be my feedback. I think that God created us in his image, and I think that means more than just to look like him. I think he created us to have, to be like him in so many ways. And so anyway, that would be my two cents on that.
Yeah, I probably like my kids enough. No, once you have kids, you're right. I do think it adds a portion to the story where you feel that. But God having a broken heart, I mean, if you believe that part or whatever, however you see that story, it definitely gives you, like Melanie said, I know there's so many other cultures that have kind of the same story, but to find that where God is like, I don't know what else to do. I've got this on this side, and I've got this on this side, and I don't know how to make it better.
We all get to choose the lens that we want to look at evidence through, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Melanie's right. There are a ton of those kind of stories, those epics of a flood, whether a large regional flood or a worldwide flood, besides the Genesis account.
Right.
And when I look at it. And some would argue it's because the lens that I was raised with and grew up in Christian faith, But when I look at it, I see, oh, well, look, there's just more evidence that this must have happened. There are so many of these stories that there's this must be. And of course, I think my story is the correct one that came down, and that is the correct version of things. But anyway, the point is I think that everybody has to be a little bit, we all look at the world through a certain lens and through a certain bias. I think I have to own it.
Yeah.
And I think that I think that too often people say, well, I don't have a bias. I choose not to. I don't know. I mean, I think we all tend to come at things through a lens. Sometimes it's the lens we grew up with. Sometimes it's a lens that we've chosen that we think makes more sense. But I think we're a lot less logical than we like to admit when it comes down to it, that most of us are guided by some kind of emotional feeling. Jonathan Haidt talks about that in, I can't remember which one of his books that he talks about, but basically that your emotions are the elephant and your logic is the rider on top of the elephant. And generally a rider can suggest to the elephant where they want it to go. And if the elephant's really well trained, then it will sometimes go. But if that elephant decides it wants to go, it will take logic with it. And emotions sure, will yeah. sometimes take our logic with it when we get provoked and when we feel upset or hurt or angry or whatever.
Some of those you never know you have until you're actually confronted with, never considered that. Why didn't I consider that? Oh, maybe it's because I really feel this way. And it's like, well, I guess we're going to have to reevaluate. And then it's like, oh yeah, I guess I do have a bias. How about that? Yeah. Yeah, no, I tend to think of it like you do though, that man, all these other stories and you know, the geological record and different things, I think it happened, but that's the lens that I'm looking at it through. All right. So that means we're out of questions. We're out of Melanie's. And what's left next week?
Next week, we're going to talk about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's wells. I'm thinking I'm going to call the sermon, Go Dig a Well. I am really looking. You know what? When I started thinking about water stories, one of the things I thought, okay, I want to tell some of the really well-known ones, but then I want to tell some ones that yeah. we don't. I've never preached a sermon
really
on Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's digging of wells in the book of Genesis. And so I'm doing that. I have preached a sermon on John where it talks about Jesus sitting at Jacob's well with the Samaritan woman. Yeah. And I'll briefly touch on that in this sermon, but that's not going to be the necessarily the overarching. Okay. There's going to be a point to it, but I'm also going to talk about the seven generation theory.
Wow.
All right. Seven.
Yeah. So I'm still working on this sermon, so I reserve the right to change any of this at any moment. But in the work that I've done, I feel quite confident I'll be talking about the seven generation theory. If you Google it, you'll discover this is a theory, or I shouldn't say a theory, but a principle that the Iroquois Nation had.
Really?
And should I tease it a little bit? Or
sure.
Basically, that when you make plans, you need to make plans with the thought of how will this impact seven generations from now.
Okay. Wow.
And so we're going to talk about going and digging a well.
Man, the first thing I think of when you said that, and I know it's not biblical, but when the chosen start out, I don't know, what is it? That's at the end of season one, I want to say. When they are, Jacob is going to dig the well and the person that's from that country is like, boy, did you get sold a bill of goods? And they're digging with their hands in the ground and the water comes up and you're thinking, you know, and again, there's nothing in the Bible to say that happened that way. But I'm just saying, just thinking of that and thinking that God, if he wanted to, could have done it that way. And it always makes me smile because I often wonder, just like thinking the flood and all these things, there's so much that we don't know that made these decisions and that went into what God was thinking. And so anyway, that was just that one made me smile when you said it. Okay. Summer of Wetmore series. And then how many more do we have to go before we're
how much longer? Are we there? No. This has been a long summer already.
These have been fun. And I'm like, I think we have a total of seven?
Eight.
Oh, man. So, yeah. Oh, good. So we've got a ways to go yet.
Yeah, I think we're on our third.
This will be week three.
Yeah.
Excellent. Hey, swipe up in today's show notes and click the link over to the Discord channel and join us there if you haven't. And we'll put some of the a couple of VBS pictures in there, including the really cool stage, and then also that invitation to maybe stop by and join us for Friday for a little bit.
Come on.
You get to hang out with Ken, Randy, Lucas, Melanie, the team, staff, and some other volunteers and do something good.
Yeah.
Do it.
Do it. Right?
Yeah. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.